Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Carlos here with us for another hour. Carlo Broussard, one of the greats. In a little while, I'll give you information on how you can get Carlo to come be a speaker at your event or location or institution, because you really should have Carlo out to speak. The number here, though, if you just want to talk to Carlo, 888-318-7884. We're doing the whys of Catholic belief this hour. And we've got three lines open. We did just a minute ago, we didn't, and now we've got three lines open. So perfect time to call with your why. I do want to invite people who are not believers or don't have religious faith. If you have basic questions about why we believe in God or why we believe in an objective morality or why we would believe that Jesus is God, all those things are welcome, and we love talking about them. And you're not wasting our time. You're helping us spend it profitably if you call. So we'd love to have you here. 888-318-7884. Carlo, thanks for coming back for another hour.
Thanks for having me, buddy.
Well, I didn't have anybody else I could go to. I had to come back to you. There's nobody else in the building, Carlo.
That is true.
Sorry, that didn't.
I'm the only apologist here.
A little more negative than I wanted.
And
yeah, you are
like
the only apologist here.
One day out of the week.
I know, because it is different since the since Trent left us and Joe joined us, and
he's remote and
lives somewhere.
Jimmy does his work from home, and Tim Staples
comes
in. Tim's
got the health stuff.
Yeah, once a week.
Yeah, and then there's you.
There's me?
We totally.
I'm just a riffraff, the bottom of the barrel, man. You just like.
Or you're the top of the barrel because you're here. You're the first one we think of because you're here in the office with us. Did I give out the number? Yeah, I think I did. 888-318-7884. I love giving it out, so I'll just give it out again. Michael in San Antonio, Texas is next. And I don't know why. I have a lot of information on the station Michael is listening on. KJMA 89.7 FM, San Antonio, Texas. Thanks for all of that information, Edgar. Michael, thanks for your call. You got a why question for Carlo?
Sure do. Thanks for taking my call, guys.
Happy to.
Carlo, why did God create Lucifer if he knew it was going to be Satan and just cause all this destruction and evil?
Right. Well, it's kind of a short answer, Michael, although it's very nuanced and complicated as you go deeper into it. But the short answer is God did so because he saw the permitted evil that Satan would bring about as contributing to the good of the whole of the order of providence. This gets to the fundamental mystery of God's permission of evil, in this case, moral evil, within his created order. So that's the answer, at least as far as we can go, by the natural light of human reason, to say as to why God would permit it. Because God wills the permission insofar as he will order it to a greater good, the good of the whole of the created order. Now, through Christian revelation, we see with greater clarity what that precise good is, namely the crucifixion and death and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ, through which humanity is elevated to a level of greater dignity through grace than it would have had through grace without the permission of Satan's fall and Adam and Eve's sin and sin entering into the created reality itself. And so that's sort of the short answer to it, that we can provide an explanation. But then often, Michael, the hang-up is that this seems to be a problem that God would even permit such evil in the first place. But there's really no problem here, Michael, because God is not bound to create at all. And given that he's not bound to create at all, because there's nothing in God that demands that he must create in order to be God, right? God's completely free to create or not to create. And given that he's not bound to create, he's not even bound to create a particular order of providence. He's not bound to create in any special way. He could have created an order of providence with no evil, no moral evil whatsoever, but he was also free to create a reality that involves moral evil, that he permits to come about, but only in as much as it's playing a part and a role in fitting within the good for the good of the greater whole. And so that's sort of the short answer to the question. Now, for many, that's hard to swallow. That's a hard pill to swallow because of modern sensibilities. But the bottom line, Michael, is that God is not bound in any way to create. And given that he is free to create, he's free to create whatever order he sees fit. And we know, given his infinite power, his infinite knowledge, that is perfectly wise and ordered in with regard to the permitted evil. That is to say that the permitted evil has its perfect fit in place within this whole scheme of things, right? And that the permitted evil of Satan's sin, the permitted evil of Adam's sin, the permitted evil of your sin and my sin, Michael, God will order it to a greater good that we might not see with clarity now, but given Christian revelation, Michael, we will see with clarity at the end of time, at the final judgment, at the time of which we will rejoice in this wisely ordered plan of God, which involves permitted moral evil.
Michael, Kay?
Yeah, that's like Marty used to say, man, that's heavy.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to
re-listen
to that one.
Yeah.
Wait, who's Marty?
Are you talking about Marty McFly?
Oh, yeah. Marty McFly. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, Marty used to say that, but he'll also say it in the future, and then he'll go back into the past again and
well,
say
we
it
actually
again.
Are. I think we already passed the future point when he went into the future two days ago. It was like Marty McFly's 2023 day or something. I don't know.
I didn't know that. So Marty McFly's future trip where he rides on a hoverboard.
Yeah, that's right. So
already happened.
Apparently it already happened. So
we don't have other hoverboards.
I know, right? Too bad.
What a rip off.
Michael, thank you for your call, buddy.
Thank you, Michael. I think I am going next to Nick in Florida, watching on YouTube. Nick, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I live pretty close to the Mary Queen of the Universe Shrine in Orlando. And the last time I was there, there's a giant, beautiful statue of the Archangel out front. And there's a whole bunch of dollar bills and money stuck between toes and fingers and laid around. My question is, why is that not a idolatry thing, sacrificing money and giving money to a statue.
What's the name of the place? Could you just say the name of it again? Our Lady what?
It's the Mary Queen of the Universe Shrine in Orlando, right off I-4.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
All right, Nick. So I'm not familiar with it, and I'm not familiar with the setup. So I'm, in a sense, shooting in the dark here. So I'm just going to try to articulate some principles, and maybe you might be able to take those principles and apply it to the concrete situation that you have more knowledge of. So let's consider the idea of placing money before a statue in and of itself, is that idolatrous activity? Well, my first thought, Nick, is not necessarily, because the money could be placed there, whether it's in a box that's locked with a little hole in it, or whether it's just open in the front of the statue, the money could be placed there as a donation to the shrine. And we often see this in regular churches, right? When you go in front of our Lady statue and there's candles, you light a candle and you put money in the box. The act of putting money in the box, the act of giving that money, has wrapped up in it, right? The nature of that activity is making a donation to the church. It is not an act of sacrificing my money to the person whom this statue represents as an offering, and thereby it being sacrifice, and thereby being idolatry. So I would be hesitant to conclude automatically this is idolatry, because it could very well be them making a donation to the shrine. It's just in this case, it's kind of loosey-goosey, right? They're just putting money out there and hoping that people come, the appropriate people come and take the money. Now, with that said, is it possible that some people are engaging in an act of idolatry in putting money in the presence of a statue? Mm. Absolutely. Yes, it's possible. A particular individual might be assigning the meaning to that action, like putting money in the presence of a statue, assigning to that visible exterior action as an act of idolatry, because that act of idolatry is ultimately going to be rooted in the intention of the heart. In this case, the giving of money is a sacrifice offered to the saint that this statue represents. And if a person has that inner motivation and they're intending to make an act of sacrifice for this person as an act of worship or adoration, then that would indeed be idolatry. So it's a little bit complex here, Nick. It's a little complex with regard to whether this particular individual is guilty of idolatry or not, simply based on the empirical fact that they're putting money in front of a statue. I think more evidence would need to be acquired as to whether it is an act of idolatry or not. And ultimately, I think only God's going to know that.
Nick, what do you think?
I think that's about as good an answer I'm going to get.
Well,
I mean, just going ask the person, hey, you just put money in front of the statue. Are you worshiping? Is that a sacrifice for the person? You know, I mean, we just don't know.
But we wouldn't want to claim that Catholics are above sinning. I mean, the sin of idolatry is committed in Catholic churches and just like any other sin. So we wouldn't want to deny that. But neither, Carl, you've never been to this church. You don't know the traditions there or the customs.
I don't.
We just don't know it.
Shrine right outside of Disney World.
Now talk about idolatry, Disney. No, I'm just kidding.
Whoa, dude. opened up the floodgates of emails.
I don't know anything about Disney World either. I apologize for that ridiculous comment. sorry, Nick. I kind of messed up your call there at the end, but are you all right?
No, that's okay.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for the call.
You guys are awesome. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll be right back with more The Whys of Catholic Belief right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features daily Mass, prayers, articles, and meditations in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church. On the web at Magnificat.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
It is a tremendous privilege to be able to speak to so many of you and to know that so many of you are listening to The Answers, which we want to give you so that you can know the truth of Jesus and come to love Him more.
EWTN Open Line Wednesday with Father Mitch Pacwa tonight, 10 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host, and Carla Broussard is our guest. And I want to remind you that this T-shirt, this hoodie, not T-shirt, this hoodie that I'm wearing, that's 25th anniversary Catholic Answers Live, because this month we celebrate our 25th anniversary here at Catholic Answers Live. You can get it over at shop.catholic.com, but why not spin the wheel and see if you can win one? You just go over to shop.catholic.com, spin the wheel. And there's a game there that pops up. Play the game and enter your information. And then right after the show, they're going to pick a winner for today's prize of a Catholic Answers Live 25th anniversary T-shirt. Coming right back here to San Diego, Patrick in San Diego, listening on 93.7 FM. Patrick, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
I was just wondering why we Catholics insist on the body and blood of Christ. It's in an appearance of bread and wine, where there was a heresy way back when, where somebody said that Jesus wasn't God and man. He was only God and only appeared like man or something like that.
Right.
But why can't we say that it's really bread and really Jesus, like Jesus was really man and really God?
Yeah, Patrick, that's a good question. And many people throughout the tradition of Christianity have, since the time of the advent of the Protestant Reformation, have followed that line of reasoning and asked that very question and came to the conclusion, well, the Eucharist is the real presence of Jesus, but it's alongside the reality of bread that's still present there. A label that theologians throw around to describe this sort of belief is consubstantiation, but that's just some, you know, fancy word that's used as a label to describe what you just described. So as to why we don't believe this, ultimately, Patrick, is because the guardian of God's revelation concerning this mystery of faith, namely the magisterium of the Catholic Church, has definitively taught us that in divine revelation, we have Jesus teaching us and giving us the mystery that he becomes present in the Eucharist, body, blood, soul, and divinity, where the bread entirely ceases to exist and the wine entirely ceases to exist, and only Jesus' body and blood becomes present. So ultimately, Patrick, we rely upon the authority of the church teaching us to be a part of God's divine revelation. I will concede that it's difficult to extract from the scriptural evidence that you have bread entirely ceasing and only Jesus's body and blood being present in the Eucharist. That's pretty hard to extract from the scriptural evidence that we often appeal to concerning the real presence of Jesus, namely the bread of life discourse in John 6 and the Last Supper of Matthew 26, for as one example among many. But ultimately, for this particular belief that bread ceases, only Jesus' body and blood become present, wine ceases, only Jesus' body and blood becomes present, is based upon the church infallibly teaching us so. Now, there is some philosophical argumentation that some have proposed to justify that claim, St. Thomas Aquinas being one of them. In his Summa Theologiae, when he's talking about the Eucharist, he addresses this question of why bread can no longer be there and only the reality of Jesus' body and blood. And he gives some very sophisticated philosophical arguments that go beyond what we can talk about here. But if you just go online, Patrick, and Google St. Thomas Aquinas and consubstantiation, it ought to direct you to the appropriate place in that work of his called the Summa Theologiae, where he articulates these philosophical reasons as to why, after the words of consecration, bread can no longer be there, but only the presence of the body and blood of Jesus.
If you'd like to hang on, Patrick, it's up to you. I can send you a little booklet we have called 20 Answers to the Eucharist, and it gets into these things, including that question, but in other things regarding the Eucharist as well. So just hang on if you'd like that, and we'll send it to you. I'm going to go to Matt in Dallas. Have you got that, Edgar? All right. I'm going to go to Matt in Dallas, Texas, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Mark, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Yeah, two things. First of all, your previous caller, I was a Protestant for a long time, and one of the reasons I became Catholic was intense research on con versus transubstantiation. And there are several things out there. If you Google miracles of the Eucharist and a new book written by a cardiologist as to real presence, it will give you the scientific answers of times when secular MDs, pathologists, and cardiologists have all examined bleeding Eucharist and have come to the conclusion that it had heart muscle,
right,
RNA, DNA, and blood type. So I'm not going to get into that now, but the answer's out there for anybody who really wants to research it. My question is more, and this is something I really struggle with, is I cannot receive the Eucharist currently, and that's by choice. And as I come back to the church, I'm stunned by what I consider to be, and one of the things I do like that my Protestant brothers and sisters have is biblical knowledge. Now, granted, I'm not going to get into the 72 versus 66 books arguments and Luther and all that, but one of the things I really struggle with is this idea of how lukewarm Catholics are when receiving the Eucharist. And I know in looking at mortal sin, and I want to ask you guys this question, is whether somebody has mortal sin on their soul when they receive communion, that's none of my business. That's between them and Jesus. my question to you is, why don't priests talk a little bit more about this? Because my understanding is that if you receive the Eucharist with mortal sin on your soul, that's a serious, serious, serious issue for your eternal soul. So would you talk a little bit about that? Because I see hundreds of people going for communion on Sunday, but when I see the confessional at 5 o'clock before the Saturday night mass, there's two people. I was trying to do the math in my head going, people haven't been to confession for years, and yet they're going to communion weekly. That seems to be a really big issue.
All right.
I'd like to get your guys' perspective on that. Thank you.
All right, Mark. Thank you for calling. So my first thought is this. I would caution myself, as I think through this personally, I would want to caution myself, and I would invite you to caution yourself, to be so quick to judge the so many people that are in the pews and not in the lines of confession. Is it probably the case that a lot of them might be guilty of mortal sin and they should be going to confession? Yes, but we want to be very cautious about making those judgments, brother, okay? So it may very well be that those people don't have the guilt of mortal sin on their soul and they're appropriately going up to Holy Communion. So we don't want to make any judgments there. Now, with that said, it is true, Mark, that St. Paul is very clear and 1 Corinthians 11, 27 through 29, that we should not be partaking of the Eucharist in the state of mortal sin. If you partake of the Holy Eucharist in an unworthy manner, you are guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. That's St. Paul's words. That's an idiom for being guilty of murder, right? So that's some pretty severe language. And then in verse 29, if you don't discern the body and you eat and drink, you drink judgment upon yourself. In other words, damnation upon yourself. So as Catholics, we simply uphold St. Paul's theology on the Eucharist here. His inspired teaching about not partaking of the Eucharist when we are guilty of mortal sin, when we are aware that we've created grave, serious sin, we had full knowledge, deliberate consent, we have the guilt of mortal sin, we ought not to approach Holy Communion. Should priests be teaching that? The answer, yes. Why? Because it's a part of divine revelation. It's a part of God's word. And we want to teach all of God's word. Now, should we be emphasizing that every single homily? Should a priest be emphasizing that every single homily? Well, of course not. Just like you're not going to emphasize every single topic every time because people are going to just tune out and they're not going to hear the message. So there has to be prudence with the timing and the manner of preaching that truth. But nevertheless, the truth must be preached. Now, your ultimate question mark was, why don't priests mention this more? And brother, I don't know. I mean, I could speculate. Possibly they don't want to talk about the hard stuff. They don't want to talk about mortal sin because it makes people uncomfortable. If people are uncomfortable, they're not going to give as much to the donation basket. Although that's an assumption that could be challenged because often it is the case whenever priests talk about hard truths, the collections increase, right? Because people want the truth. They're desiring the truth. So anyway, the point, Mark, is that we ultimately don't know why the priest is making the judgment in his mind, I'm not going to emphasize mortal sin and teach the people that they ought not to approach Holy Communion if they are in the state of mortal sin. That's between them and God. As you just said, concerning the people who might be in a state of mortal sin, that's between them and God. So too with these priests. But should they teach it? The answer is definitely yes. Now, as to how much and at which time and the manner, those are going to be dictated by prudence.
I think I'm going to leave that there because, again, the lines are full. So I thank you very much, Mark, for that call and for that question. Let's see. Where shall we go? We're going to Matt in South Carolina, listening on the EWTN app. Matt, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Carla.
Hey guys, huge fan. Can you hear me okay?
You're kind of faint a little bit. Is there any way you could get closer to the phone?
Yeah, sure. How about now? Is this better?
Way better.
Okay. Hey, my question is, why do we as Catholics subscribe to just war theory when Jesus tells us to turn the other cheek?
Excellent question, Matt, and I'm to be honest with you, brother, I'm glad you asked this question because it gives me an opportunity to.
Are you going to try to sell your book?
No, not my book.
Oh, I thought you were going to take a question about peace.
But it gives me an opportunity to plug my podcast, Sunday Catholic Word. Oh. So for the seventh Sunday of Ordinary Time, the gospel reading is from Matthew's gospel, which talks about our Lord giving the instruction to turn the other cheek.
Yeah.
And so I spend the entire episode unpacking this teaching. And Matt, what I do there is I give reasons, at least. Oh, I hear the heartbreak.
Can you hang on, Matt?
Yeah, hang on, Matt.
Yep, absolutely.
All right.
Fantastic.
All right. Why do we have this just war theory when Jesus clearly taught us to turn the other cheek? We'll get to that question and lots more questions while we do the whys of Catholic belief with Carla Broussard right after this on Catholic Answers Live. If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live is 25 years old. That's a quarter century helping people come into deeper communion with the Catholic faith. As we move into our second quarter century, please help us reach thousands more by becoming a Society 315 monthly donor. Right now, when you join Society 315 at a monthly giving level of $25 or more, we've added some extra perks to the other great benefits we already offer members. Go to givecatholic.com and choose the monthly option to start your donation.
As a child, the great theologian Thomas Aquinas asked, "What is God?" Best-selling author Kevin Vost's new book follows the mature thought of Aquinas in answering that question. In clear and approachable fashion, What is God examines God's attributes and considers questions about him that have vexed mankind for centuries. Order your copy of What is God today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Jonette Williams. We bring you the truth of the Catholic faith on Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and Carla Broussard is our guest this hour. And Matt from South Carolina has a fantastic question. He just summed it up. If Jesus says, turn the other cheek, why do we have a just war theory? I mean, Jesus is the Prince of Peace. He says, blessed are the peacemakers. There's a lot of peace in there, Matt. Is that correct in your reading of the Gospels?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. All right. So what's this just war theory thing about, Carla?
Okay, well, first of all, with regard to that, I'm glad you brought that up. But just for our listeners' sake, they can check out paragraph 2309 in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which lays out the traditional conditions for just war.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to get on the table here. But Matt's question had to do with Jesus's instruction in Matthew 5 to turn the other cheek.
Yeah.
And by the way, Matt, you can also check online at Catholic.com. Our colleague and good friend Tim Staples wrote an article specifically on this issue entitled Turn the Other Cheek. So you can look that up. But basically, I would take this first strategy. We need to show first that Jesus does not intend for us to interpret this in a passivist way. That is, we are to never engage in violence, even when we think it is justified. And the reason why we shouldn't take a passivist interpretation is because if we did, Matt, then Jesus would be contradicting himself. So, for example, in Luke 22, 36 through 38, Jesus approves taking up a sword for self-defense. He tells the apostles, "Let him who has no sword sell his cloak and buy one." And they said, "Look, Lord, here are two swords." And he said to them, "It's enough." So that's Jesus approving the use of the sword within certain circumstances to legitimately defend oneself and engage in justified violence. We do not want to say that Jesus is contradicting himself. And so therefore, we should conclude, we should reject the pacifist interpretation of, quote unquote, turning the other cheek. And there are other reasons that we could give as to why we should reject the pacifist interpretation. But we don't have time to do that here. I would encourage you once again and our listeners, be on the lookout for my Sunday Catholic Word,
this
episode
Sunday.
13, seventh Sunday of Ordinary Time.
So Friday this week.
Is that this week? I have no idea, man. I'm so lost.
Oh, I was asking you.
Okay. I don't know.
All right.
So anyway, okay. So now, Matt, now that we have reason why not to take the pacifist interpretation, the question arises, well, what does Jesus mean? Now, there are different interpretations and plausible explanations as to what Jesus does mean. The one that I find very persuasive is what Jesus is doing here is that he is teaching his disciples to be willing to bear persecution for his sake without retaliation. Now, you might ask, well, how in the world do you get that out from turning the other cheek? Well, the way that Jesus is articulating this, it would involve a strike on the right cheek, okay? So now, why would a strike on the right cheek be a form of persecution for Jesus? Well, people are normally right-handed. And so, Si, if I'm right-handed, if I'm going to slap you on the right cheek, that's going to be a backhanded slap.
Okay.
And according to Jewish culture, with that sort of slap, that was very demeaning, and you could be entitled to legal compensation, but that would be a form of persecution if I didn't like what you were believing. Were the early Christians being persecuted? Yes, they were being persecuted by synagogue officials. And so the synagogue officials would have likely been the candidates to be striking the Christian disciples on the right cheek with a backhand indicating that they're persecuting them for their belief in Jesus. And this actually fits with the Greek word that's used for strike here in Matthew 5. It's the same Greek word in Matthew 26, 67 at the trial of Jesus when they're slapping Jesus.
Okay.
For his claims to be the Messiah and the Son of the living God climbing on the clouds of heaven. It also fits within the very context of Jesus' teaching here in Matthew 5 about loving enemies. Right within that context, Jesus is talking about loving enemies. And so some have suggested, Matt, that what Jesus is getting at here by turning the other cheek, that is to say, when you're slapped on the cheek with a right-handed slap, that would be on your, you know, that would be on your right side of your cheek with my right hand, turn the other cheek to be slapped again because, as Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, blessed is he who is persecuted for my sake. So it's the instruction to endure the persecution without retaliation. And here's the bottom line. If this is true, and Jesus is instructing his apostles to endure persecution without retaliation within this specific context of being persecuted for Jesus, it does not follow from that that we should never retaliate with violence whenever we are attacked. Did you see the distinction between the two?
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
So, Matt, there's a lot more to that, but that's a summary of what I get into in the episode for my podcast and even what Tim Staples touches on in his article. What do you think of that, brother?
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. I look forward to the podcast.
Awesome. Cool. Appreciate
it. Very good, Matt. Thank you very much.
SundayCatholicWord.com.
SundayCatholicWord.com. Do we have any books we can give, Matt? Let's give him one of yours, Carl. Pick one. Prepare the Way.
First
book. We don't get enough questions on peace. I really am grateful for it, Matt, because as much as I know that the church is not wrong in its teaching on war and peace, but I also know that oftentimes we as Catholics are awful lazy as far as peacemaking goes.
Sure.
That we give ourselves up, well, the church says it's all right. Well, that doesn't mean all war is all right or we need all the wars we've got.
And even when it is justified, there might, well, if there are other
there's nonviolent other ways.
Means, it wouldn't be justified in that case. So we always, and see this, I'm glad you brought that up, because as Tim Staples points out in his article, one possible interpretation is that Jesus is using hyperbole here, which would fit within the context, because Jesus says, if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. Well, eye doesn't cause you to sin. He's using hyperbole here. So if he's using hyperbole, then the question becomes, well, what's the meaning of the hyperbole? What's the point being emphasized? Yeah. And one plausible explanation is that he's emphasizing we need to have a proper disposition to peace and not be always looking for violence, but have a disposition of peace. That doesn't mean you can never retaliate with justified violence. It just means you need to have a disposition of peace to where we're seeking for peaceful means to bring about peaceful ends, right? And then only in extraordinary circumstances when necessary and nothing else is available to us do we resort to the violence.
Yeah, yeah. Matt, I'll tell you what. Just tell Edgar which book of Carlo's you want. He can tell you the titles and whatever book you want, because I wish we talked about peace more. I really do. Jesus is the Prince of Peace, and it wouldn't hurt us to talk a little bit more about how to make peace in the world. Let's go to Shannon in Sunnyvale, California, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Shannon, go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Hi, Carlo and Si. My question comes from my husband, who is not Catholic, and he would wonder, why does the Holy Father have free will if he can't lead the church into error?
All right.
And is he one of the non-Catholics that doesn't know how to use a phone, or he just doesn't want to talk to us?
He keeps asking me, and I don't know the answer.
No, okay, yeah, we're glad to have the question. Thanks, Shannon.
Well, Shannon, thank you. The reason why the charism of infallibility doesn't violate the Pope's free will is because the charism of infallibility is simply a guardrail that provides certain boundaries, parameters, that God will see to it that the Pope does not teach error. So within these parameters, the Pope's discerning, he's using his free will, he's making an act of the will, saying, I'm going to teach this doctrine, Doctrine X, right? And it's in conformity with God's will. The Pope intends to teach Doctrine X, bind it on all of Catholics and Christians to believe, and he's using free will. Free will is there at every step of the way. Now let's consider a scenario where the Pope, using his free will, hypothetically says, I'm going to teach Doctrine Z, or Z, as others will say.
I'm going to teach
Doctrine Z. And let's just say, Shannon, Doctrine Z happens to be heretical and happens to be contrary to God's revelation and the deposit of faith. So God's going to see to it that the Holy Father does not enact a teaching and bind it on us in a definitive way. Now, at every step of the way, so he might wake up in the morning not alive anymore, right?
You don't wake up in the morning not alive anymore. That never happens.
That's a contradiction, right?
No one has ever woken up in the morning not alive anymore.
That's a good point. Hey, see, you're a philosopher, dude.
Yeah, right.
You just picked up on a contradiction there. Yeah, so God might see to it that he dies and protect the church from that error in that way. Does that mean the Pope didn't have free will or doesn't have free will? Of course not. The Pope was exercising his free will along the entire way. Just God put a stop to what was going to happen. Sort of like if I, pull the trigger on a gun and the bullet starts flying to someone and God performs a miracle and melts the bullet or directs the bullet away from someone. That would not take away from my free will and freely choosing to shoot the gun. Similarly, the Holy Father, using his free will, is going to intend to teach this erroneous doctrine and bind it on the consciences of all the people of God here on earth. Well, God can perform an act within history and make it be such that the teaching doesn't get promulgated. So maybe he has it on paper and he's going to give it to the secretary to go and officially publish it, right? And it like burns up or it gets lost or it never becomes officially promulgated in such a way. Something of that nature, Shannon. That's what we mean when we say God is going to protect the Pope from officially, definitively teaching error to the Church of God here on earth and binding us to believe it. Those guardrails do not in any way impede or violate the free will of the Holy Father. The free will, the Holy Father is exercising his free will, playing within the playground, right? Within the parameters of the playground. But once he intends to cross that boundary, God will see to it that he doesn't, in a way that does not violate his free will.
Okay.
All right, Shannon.
That sounds good.
Shannon,
thank you.
Any chance that your husband would be interested in Trent Horn's book, Why We're Catholic?
We have that book already.
Oh, you have that
book. But I'd be curious about the Carlo's other book, the Meeting the Protestant.
The Challenge?
Are you shopping right response. Now, Shannon? Were you are you treating this as a shopping trip? Okay. No, let's send Carlos two books, Meeting the Protestant Challenge and Meeting the Protestant Response. We'll send you both of those. Thanks,
I
Shannon.
I think we have the first one, but I appreciate it.
Oh, you have the first one, so you want the second one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Meeting the Protestant Response.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Can I go to checkout now, or would you like to put anything else on your shopping list before we go to checkout? Thanks, Shannon. We got to take a break.
I'm all good.
Hang on the line. We'll get you that book. Right back with more Carla Broussard, Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN uses the power of radio to reach people whenever and wherever they're searching for answers to questions about their Catholic faith. EWTN Radio is heard on over 500 domestic and international AM and FM radio affiliates. For a complete list of programs and how to hear EWTN Radio, visit EWTN.com and click radio. EWTN, the global Catholic network.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Carla Broussard is our guest, and we're doing the whys of Catholic belief, and people have gotten it today. So you ever, you know, sometimes you do an hour, and it's like, did people understand what the premise of the hour was? But like, it's a lot of why questions.
It's true.
Today.
They're all really coming in as why XYZ.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. I appreciate that. And we got room for one more. So if you want to dial right now, we'll get you in because we got room for one more. 888-318-7884. And while we're waiting for that call, we'll go to Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Jason, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Thanks for taking my call. I was just curious, why can or can't converts get rebaptized?
All right. Well, Jason, it's going to depend because it is the case in some scenarios where somebody who's converting and coming into the Catholic Church, they are rebaptized with what is called a conditional baptism. If there is reasonable enough evidence that either A, the baptism that was received initially was invalid, maybe it was done in the name of Christ, you know, Redeemer, Sanctifier, etc., it's something other than the Trinity without proper form, invalid, or maybe it was there's good reason to believe that the one performing the baptism had a positive intention contrary to, in opposition to, what the Catholic Church teaches. That would be a lack of an intention that needs to be with the form and with the matter. Maybe pure water wasn't used. Maybe something else was used, apple juice or something. I don't know. Then that would be invalid. So in that case, this wouldn't be a conditional baptism. This would just be a baptism, right? Because we have, hey, your first baptism was invalid. Let's get you validly baptized. Okay. Now, there's also a conditional baptism. And this is normally conducted, Jason, whenever someone is unaware that they were baptized. They're like, well, I think I was baptized. And even if I was, I really don't know if it was valid. And so the priest will conduct a conditional baptism for the convert. And basically it's, if you have not been already baptized, I baptize you in the name of the Father and the Son of the Holy Spirit. So I say all that simply to clarify for our listeners and for you, Jason, that some converts are rebaptized. Now, for those converts who have a valid baptism and the church recognizes it as such, the church does not rebaptize because the church upholds the teaching of St. Paul in Ephesians 4, 5. There is one faith, one baptism, one Lord. So we affirm that there is one baptism. So once you have been validly baptized, you receive, as the church teaches, this indelible mark or character that theologians refer to on the soul that constitutes you as separated unto the Lord. You belong to the Lord. And that's an indelible mark. Once you receive that on the soul, you cannot lose it. It's there. And so because of that one baptism that's revealed to us, we do not rebaptize. Because to rebaptize you, Jason, knowing that you've had a valid baptism, the church would basically be saying, well, we don't believe that the Trinity and the water and the intention was sufficient to validly baptize you. So that would be actually expressing something contrary to what we believe. So we want to be consistent as Catholics. We want to say, hey, proper form, matter, and intention, you got it, baby. You baptize. So if I go around rebaptizing you, what does that imply? I don't believe that stuff, right? Yeah. And so we're being consistent with our belief, Jason, that proper form and matter is going to validly baptize you. And we're going to run with that for the rest of your existence.
Perfect. That makes total sense. Thank you. And I guess the reason why I was asking is because I don't know if I've been baptized, and I'm thinking of converting.
Yes. Okay. Oh, so
yeah. You hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, right, there you go. The right. All right. Well, thank you.
So I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, buddy. Whenever you go to the parish and you talk to the pastor and say, hey, I'm looking to convert, he's going to probably talk to you about what is called RCIA, the Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults. You go through the classes and inquire and all of that, learn the stuff about Catholicism. And in that conversation, make sure that you explain to them, listen, I don't know. And the pastor will know what to do. He'll be like, okay, yeah, well, we need to do a conditional baptism here.
Jason, do you have a copy of Trent Horn's book, Why We're Catholic?
I do not.
If you'd like a copy, I won't ask you on the air whether you'd like a copy, but if you'd like a copy, I'll put you on hold right now, and Edgar will pick up the line, and we'll send you a copy, because if you are considering coming into communion with the Catholic Church, we'd like to be as helpful and encouraging as we can in that regard, and I hope you'll call again. I'm going to try to get as many callers on with Carlo as I can before we have to go, so off we go to Dan in Fargo, North Dakota, listening on Real Presence Radio. Dan, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Hi.
Hi, Dan.
I have a question about why it is that when answering the question of being saved, as the Protestants say, the answer to Romans 10, 9 and 10 is never answered adequately. All that I've ever heard theologians or read in books is kind of a circle talk about faith. But the point that is always overlooked is that in Romans 6, it says that these are baptized Romans. Do you not know, it says. And then in chapter 1, it says that they have a faith that's known around the world. So I would think that it should have been mentioned when answering that question that these are baptized Christians from the Roman Church, not the emperor's crowd or something,
right,
but from the Roman Church, who are baptized and full of faith, you know, and that's the faith that's going to save them. That never gets mentioned. So
that's a very interesting take.
Yeah, you know, Dan, I'll be honest with you. I've never thought about Romans 10, 9 through 10, and using that to press our Protestant friends, because normally, Si, what's going on, when one appeals to Romans 10, 9 through 10, they take it as an exhortation that's to be given to someone prior to the initial stage of justification. If you believe, if you confess with your lips that Jesus is Lord, you will be saved. So have faith and enter into a state of salvation. But as Dan is pointing out here, Paul is writing to saved Christians.
Yeah, right.
And so the exhortation to confess with your lips and you will be saved, given the audience to whom Paul is writing here, this is not applying to an exhortation being given to people prior to justification.
No.
It's an exhortation being given to those who have already been justified. And notice Paul says, you will be saved.
Yeah.
Indicating that there is a future aspect to our justification and salvation, and therefore it is not a one-time event in the past, implying here that we must continue to confess Jesus as our Lord until death in order to be saved, in order to be finally saved or justified. So Dan, that's an interesting insight that you have here, my friend, that I've never considered before, but you know what? I'm going to start thinking more about it and see if we can employ it in conversations that we have with our Protestant brothers and sisters.
That's a very interesting take, Dan. What do you think?
It's evident in other books, too, you know,
yeah.
that it's Christians they're talking to, you know, like in
yeah.
Yeah.
Colossians, they talk about baptism, too, but it's not a formula like the Protestants might say.
You know, right. I mean, I do think that it's okay to take this exhortation from Paul and utilize it in evangelistic endeavors.
Sure.
For people who do not have faith or who are not baptized, who are not Christian, and say, hey, yeah, confess with your lips that Jesus is Lord and you're going to be saved. Now, of course, we understand that it's going to involve going to the waters of baptism to receive the new birth. So I think we can use the formula in evangelization, but specifically for Paul here, rather than it being directed to those who are not Christian and thus need to become Christian, is directed at those who are already Christian and indicating they have a future dimension of their salvation, which goes against the once saved, always saved doctrine that some, not all, Protestant Christians adopt. So I think this is a great insight. And you know, another important point here, Cy, and Dan, if you're still on the line with us, this often comes up when we talk about, you know, you quoted 1 Corinthians 6 or nope. Romans 6, I think you had said, where Paul talks about how they have died with Christ and they have risen with Christ through baptism. And through that baptismal death, they are justified or freed from sin. Now, if we take that into consideration, this also comes up in places where Paul warns the Romans and in his other letters, the Corinthians, who are also Christian and saved, about engaging in certain behaviors or sinful behaviors that will prohibit them from inheriting the kingdom of heaven. Now, if we're always saved as justified Christians and our eternity is secure, what need would there be of exhortations to avoid sins that can keep us out of the kingdom of heaven? If we're already secure in the kingdom of heaven. And so I think the point here, Cy, that Dan is making is crucial in apologetical discussions to emphasize the point that, hey, the audience to whom Paul is writing in these letters, Romans and others, are justified Christians. And keeping that in mind, and then we're able to see, well, man, when he warns them about avoiding mortal sin, and if you do that, you're going to not inherit the kingdom of God, that implies the possibility to lose the gift of salvation.
Yeah. Dan, when do you start your podcast?
Not going to happen.
Oh, all right. Well, I appreciate the call. That was actually a really interesting take and a very profitable conversation. So thanks. I appreciate it.
Nope.
All right.
God bless you, my friend.
But speaking of podcasts, tell us again about your... Well, first of all, I do want to let people know, because I was saying that they could get you as a speaker, but if you want Carlo to be a speaker or any of these apologists to be your speaker, but you should get Carlo. He's really good. you go to CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com. CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com. Tell us where they can get your podcast.
Sunday
Catholic.
I can't even get it right myself, man.
Yeah, I'm rubbing off on you, dude.
SundayCatholicWord.com. Or MrSundayPodcast.com.
And it drops each Friday, and it will help you reflect.
Thursday now. I've been told it drops Thursdays
now. Does it drop Thursdays now, Edgar?
Yes.
It does. Okay.
Ooh, I got it right.
Each Thursday, you can get a new episode of the Sunday Catholic Word with Carlo Roussard. Carlo, thank you. That was a very pleasant 2 hours.
Thank you. It was pleasant on my end as well, my friend.
All right. We'll see. I think that does it for us. Does that do it for us, Darren? Do we have to do anything else? Oh, you know what? I heard Jack earlier on EWTN do this, and I never do this. Thank you, Darren, who ran the board. Thank you, Edgar, who was screening the calls. Thank you, Jack, who ran the video. You all do a wonderful job here at EWTN in Birmingham, Alabama. Oh, wait, no, I shouldn't have added that part. I stole the wrong part from Jack, but thank you for all the work you do. Thank you, Carlo. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.